Greetings and salutations, Constant Listeners. I'm coming to you from the Steel City, Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. My name's Nick Deolius. You've entered the rational zone known as the far middle. We're in mid-August, and this serves as the 169th installment of the podcast. We've got a special subject and series of connections to cover today. It's a subject that I think you will enjoy. I've got a number of these, I'll call them thematic episodes, that have been in the hopper, or at least in my mind, for some time, where a singular subject of special interest can weave together with a series of connections to give the constant listener a different and a unique perspective on something they maybe have heard of or maybe somewhat familiar with, but you know, haven't seen it maybe from this different, unique perspective. Okay, let's see how this goes. And as our custom, we're going to begin with the sports dedication, and it's going to make a snug connection to the episode's topic, as you will see. We saw the Olympic Games in Paris conclude just days ago. Do you know when the modern version of those Olympic Games began? Well, not surprisingly, the ancient games were resurrected in Athens, Greece. Couldn't be anywhere else, considering that's where the games first began. But when did we bring the games back, but in the modern form that we would recognize today, close to what we just saw in Paris? Well, the answer is in 1896. The 1896 Summer Olympics, officially known as the Games of the First Olympiad, or commonly known as Athens 1896, they were the first international Olympic Games held in modern history. But get this, those Summer Games did not occur during the summer. They were played in the early spring. And the games were organized by the International Olympic Committee, the IOC, just like they are today. I'm not sure if the IOC was as corrupt as it has been in recent times, but anyway, those games back in 1896 were held in Athens in early to mid-April. And Athens has been unanimously chosen, or was unanimously chosen, to stage those inaugural modern games during a Congress in Paris in 1894, during which the IOC was also created. Again, that made a lot of sense. It was logical, with Greece being the birthplace of the ancient Olympic Games. Now, there were only 14 nations that participated in those 1896 games, and 240 or so athletes, and they were all male athletes, no women participants, and all the athletes were European or living in Europe, with the exception of the U.S. team. More than half of the competing athletes were Greek. So interestingly, I suppose the Greeks participated in the most events of any nation, if you just follow that through. And then here's another interesting tidbit about those games. Winners were given a silver medal, not gold. And runners-up, second place, received a copper medal. So only the first two finishers were recognized with a medal, silver for first and copper for second place. Now, retroactively, the IOC has converted these to gold and silver and awarded bronze medals to third-placed athletes post the 1896 games. In 10 of the 14 participating nations, they earned medals. The U.S. seemed destined for summer games dominance that we become accustomed to because the United States won the most silver, which became gold medals, 11 in total during those games. And the host nation, Greece, won the most medals overall, 47, again, probably helped by the fact that Greece fielded the most athletes. And the highlight for the Greeks was the marathon victory, which is the event at the heart of the history of the Olympics. So the 1896 Olympics, they were a great success. The games had the largest international participation of any sporting event to that date. The primary stadium for the games overflowed with the largest crowd ever to watch a sporting event. And after the games, the IOC was petitioned by several prominent figures, including Greece's king, and some of the American competitors in Athens to hold all the following games for the Olympics in Athens. But, you know, the 1900 Summer Olympics were already planned for Paris, and the Olympics didn't return to Greece until the 2004 Summer Olympics, over 100 years later. Now, I don't remember the 1896 Athens games. I wasn't around for that, but I do remember the 2004 Athens Summer Olympics. So with the recent Paris Games just concluding, and with the start of our string of connections to the special installment of the Far Middle that focuses on an intriguing historical topic, we dedicate Far Middle 169 to the first modern Olympic Games held in Athens in 1896. So now that we have the sports dedication of the first modern Olympic Games in Athens, what do you suppose our topic will be for this special episode? Well, it's someone all of us have heard of, and some of us may know a decent amount about, especially if you are a history or a military history buff. And the individual I speak of is Alexander, as in Alexander the Great. But I'm betting there are a few intriguing factoids about Alexander the Great that most of us do not know of, ones that don't have much at all to do with military battles or the nuances of his battle tactics, but things that every constant listener would find of interest and useful in their own endeavors. So let's get rolling. And our first connection will, like those 1896 Summer Olympics, it's going to stay in Greece, and it will be around Athens. But we're going to go back a bit in time. Okay, we're going to go back more than a bit in time, back 300 plus years before Christ. Because around 384 BC, a guy by the name of Aristotle was born. And we all heard of him, but it's hard to appreciate the extent of his impact. A Greek genius in the purest sense of the word, a philosopher and a polymath. His writings cover a broad range of subjects, spanning from the natural sciences, philosophy, linguistics, economics, politics, psychology, and the arts. It just goes on and on. And his traditions set the groundwork for the development of modern science. The historian Robin Lane Fox did a great job summarizing Aristotle's genius when he said that Aristotle, quote, wrote books on the constitutions of 158 different states, edited a list of the victors in the games at Delphi, discussed music and medicine, astronomy, magnets and optics, made notes on Homer, analyzed rhetoric, outlined the forms of poetry, considered the irrational side of men's nature, set zoology on a proper experimental course, was intrigued by bees, and began the study of embryology. That's from the historian Robin Lane Fox, summing up sort of the topical resume of Aristotle. And yet strangely little, very little in fact, is known about Aristotle's life. He was born in northern Greece, and he was brought up by a guardian. And as a young man, he joined Plato's Academy in Athens, and he remained there until the age of 37, which was sort of old man age back then. So think about that. Plato instructing Aristotle at Plato's Academy. Though Aristotle wrote a lot of elegant treatises and dialogues for publication, only around a third of his original output has survived time, and none of the third that survived was really intended for publication. So I always wonder about how different life would be today, or modern history would end up being, if we had the benefit of the full writings and learnings of prior great minds like Aristotle. Not just him, but all the great minds. And I also ponder if you tally up all the cumulative knowledge that mankind amassed over the eons and across the great societies, what percentage do you think survived to the modern day? Most of it? Half of it? Only a small fraction of it? It's fascinating and alternative history scenarios that I can get sucked into and lose track of time just thinking about. Anyway, shortly after Plato died, Aristotle, he leaves Athens and he ends up pursuing a very important career opportunity that impacted world history. You see, Philip II ruled Macedonia to the north of Greece, and the king wanted Aristotle, the best instructor in the land, to tutor Philip's son, Alexander. Now, Alexander was not yet known as the Great. So Philip sets up a school for Aristotle to instruct Alexander in Miesa, which was an exotic locale near Macedonia's capital. Alexander and a group of young noblemen spent 3 years at this academy learning from Aristotle. So imagine just 3 days listening to Aristotle and having Alexander as a classmate. For 3 years? My goodness. Aristotle, he prepared for Alexander a special text of the Iliad, which was Alexander's favorite work. And legend has it that Alexander kept Aristotle's text of the Iliad under his pillow. Aristotle also wrote pamphlets for Alexander on kingship and colonies and instructed him on geometry, rhetoric, the ability to debate a case from one side as well as the other. And all of these were tools that would serve Alexander quite well. Yeah, I suppose the first interesting note in our connection string about Alexander was that he had quite the elite upbringing. Your dad was king of Macedonia, your teacher was none other than Aristotle, and you attended an elite academy built especially for you. Alexander was not brought up as a common man, but as a leader his actions were that of a common soldier. He ate after his troops ate, he was treated for wounds after his army was cared for, and he slept in the same conditions of his soldiers. So it's rare, I think, to see a humble style of leadership such as his, and it's rare yet to see it executed by someone with such a privileged background. Speaking of Alexander's father, Philip II, that leads us to the next connection and intriguing aspect of Alexander the Great, which was his family dynamics. It's the stuff that modern-day soap operas and reality shows would feed off of. So check this out. Philip was, of course, Alexander's father, and his mother was Philip's wife, Olympias. She was Greek, not Macedonian, and understand, the Greek states were rivals of Macedonia, so that was a bit controversial. And when Alexander was a young man, his father decides to repudiate Alexander's mother and instead take as a new wife a Macedonian woman who already had a daughter with Philip and was expecting what was rumored to be a son. Now, if that were true, it would put Alexander's succession as the next potential ruler after his father in jeopardy. And succession risks or concerns about not being next in line in the ancient world that often resulted in homicides. And sure enough, within a year, Philip was assassinated by bodyguards on his way to the wedding of Alexander's sister. In the role that Alexander played, potentially, in his father's death, has been of historical debate for centuries. Many historians assume that Alexander was an active participant in planning his father's murder, and they often fought Alexander and Philip. They fought, and many of those fights were violent as well as public. So there's no secret there was friction, and most of the friction centered around the drama with Philip repudiating Alexander's mother and marrying another woman. But that is just one possible scenario. It was Aristotle himself who once wrote after the assassination that the murderer of Philip, the person that actually stabbed him to death, was looking to achieve revenge after Philip terminated a homosexual affair that he was having with the bodyguard who killed him. And by the way, it was common during those times that the male elite class were bisexual. Now, Alexander, he had his own theory as to who was behind the assassination of his father. He said that the murderer was political in nature and came from the backing of the Persians, who were rivals of Macedonia and who were already battling his father, Philip. And then finally, one cannot rule out that Alexander's mother, Olympias, was behind the murder of Philip. His new marriage humiliated her and hamstrung the political prospects of her son. And it's interesting to note that she had the body of the murderer taken down from its stake and cremated with honor. Interesting to say the least. As I said, the family dynamics of Alexander in his youth, before he became the great, makes whatever you heard about or experienced with your own family history seem like plain vanilla. Alexander's family was dysfunctional with a capital D. So if that was your upbringing, being taught by your father, the king, and your teacher, Aristotle, and that was the family dynamic that you were accustomed to with assassinations and succession intrigue, it's not surprising that Alexander became the ultimate in Machiavellian tactics long before there was even a Machiavelli. And I'll give you an example of this with our next connection. When Alexander would win a major battle, he would often send trophies taken from the enemy back to Greece to be hung in the temples of Athens. And he would inscribe on them, Alexander, son of Philip and the Greeks. And then in parentheses, he would write, except the Spartans. And then would continue on with, sends these spoils from the Persians in Asia. So he would say, Alexander, son of Philip and the Greeks, except the Spartans, sends these spoils from the Persians in Asia. So what was going on with this practice in the writing, the inscription that he would include? Well, two things that displayed how adept Alexander was when it came to politics and group psychology. The first was that Alexander, with the practice of sending the trophies back to Athens, and with his inscription being the son of the Greeks, he was pulling off a public relations victory. You see, Athens and much of Greece were the least reliable and the shakiest allies of Macedonia and Alexander at the time. So this tactic, it was a way to enable Alexander to transform himself into a Greek, whereby it would be more difficult for Greeks or Athenians to not stick within the alliance. Public relations coup. But then there was that part in the parentheses of that inscription. except for Sparta or except for the Spartans. What was that all about? Well, with Alexander specifically excluding the Spartans, it was a way for him to conveniently rewrite history. See, the factual version was that the Spartans were the leaders and champions when it came to Greek liberty against the oppressors in Persia. Most of you might have seen the movie 300. Well, that battle was fought by Spartans, a few hundred of them, against a massive Persian army. What Alexander was doing by sending these trophies back and excluding Sparta in the dedication was to rewrite history to a version that suited him in Macedonia. He displaced Sparta as the exemplar of Greek culture against the enemy, Persia. Public relation genius once again. This genius for messaging and public relations, it can serve as a jumping point to the connection that discusses how Alexander also had a knack to encourage debate as to what the next moves should be with his senior advisors, but that he also had a penchant for deciding a course that was counter to what those closest to him advised. Alexander didn't seem to be one to follow through on the consensus, although he always seemed to be willing to invite the opinion of others around him. So allow me to provide a few examples. The first was the debate about what to do about his enemy, Persia's formidable naval fleet in the Mediterranean. His advisors urged Alexander to seek a naval battle with the Persians, but Alexander didn't agree because he had a vision that was strategic beyond what his advisors could see. His advisors were thinking short-term and tactical victory or setback. Alexander was thinking long-term, frankly, total global domination. Therefore, Alexander chose a path that did not involve a direct naval battle. And instead, what did he do? He proceeded to take out all the Persian naval bases along the coast to, as he put it, defeat the Persian fleet from the land. It was visionary genius, and it worked. A second example of this dynamic of gathering consensus and then deciding on a different course at play occurred when Alexander won his first battle against Darius of Persia. Darius, he loses and he offers Alexander a bribe to hopefully make him go away. And it was a big bribe. Darius offered all of Asia Minor, which is effectively modern Turkey. And later, after another battle that he lost came and went, Darius upped his bid to include not just Asia Minor, but everything up to the Euphrates River, along with cash and Darius's daughter's hand in marriage. So Alexander's advisors, they hear this and they tell him he'd be crazy not to take this bribe. It was offering up things way beyond what they hoped to achieve tactically. But Alexander said, absolutely not. And his justification was that he already told Darius that he was Lord of Asia. Therefore, all of Darius's money and lands were already Alexander's, and that included Darius's daughter's hand in marriage, if Alexander wanted to take it. Turned out to be the right call. Yes, Alexander's advisors were expert checkers players, right? They were playing checkers and were really good at it. But Alexander, he was playing a game of geopolitical chess, and he was steps ahead of and on a different level from where his advisors were. And then there are two further examples of how Alexander was able to dissent from his advisors' opinions and come out vindicated. Now, these two examples, they deal more with military battle tactics. One was at the Battle of Granicus, where his advisors told him that crossing the river with the Persian army already waiting and sitting at the other side of the river on the bank would be disastrous. Alexander, once again, he saw it differently, and he felt that an attack straight across the river would create a psychological advantage for the Macedonians and result in victory. And he led the way and was one of the first to cross the river in the charge. He was a lead from the front type of commander for sure. And then the second military tactical example of this dynamic of play, it was a debate about whether the army should attack at night or during broad daylight. The advisors thought a night attack would be better, but Alexander felt it could cause confusion within his own army, and it wouldn't be befitting of the reputation of his army. Darkness, he said, belonged to robbers and waylayers, as he put it. But then he said, "But my glory shall not be diminished by stealing a victory. I am determined on an open attack." So once again, he was correct, and he won the battle, this one being Gaugamela for you history buffs. Now, despite Alexander being more than willing to follow his own course instead of that of his advisors, he also had an extreme talent when it came to oratory and connecting and inspiring his troops. An example of that can serve as our next connection to, again, offer an insight into Alexander the Great beyond the battles that many of us may not appreciate. Now, when you're looking to conquer the known world over the course of years, there's going to be times where your army and your rank and file troops, they grow weary, they become frustrated. And Alexander and his army were certainly not immune to that phenomenon, considering that he had his army at war and moving thousands of miles from home over the course of years. Now, how he dealt with this challenge can best be illustrated by one of the key incidents when his army became frustrated, which was in faraway India. To inspire his troops and motivate them to stay with him, he focused on his ability to lead from the front and subject himself to what the common soldier experienced. Now, here are his words. "I have no part of my body, in front at least, that is left without scars. There is no weapon used at close quarters or hurled from afar of which I do not carry the mark. I have been wounded by the sword, shot with arrows, struck from a catapult, smitten many times with stones and clubs for you, for your glory, for your wealth." Boy, you talk about a guilt trip. But he wasn't finished. He continued on with, "Depart all of you, and when you reach home, tell them that your king, Alexander, victor over the Persians, tell them, I say, that you deserted him, that you took yourselves off, leaving him to the care of the wild tribes you conquered. This, when you declare it, will no doubt be glorious among men and pious in the sight of heaven. Be gone." Yeah, he certainly had a sense for the dramatic. And he was a great public speaker, and he coupled this speech with some sulking theatrics over the next few days. And by the end of the performance, his army was ready to follow him anywhere and for as long as he liked. It would be interesting to see what Alexander could accomplish in today's political arena using modern technology. I think he would be a formidable debate opponent. I hope you enjoyed this episode and its string of connections discussing those key aspects, but maybe unknown or underappreciated aspects that made Alexander the Great. It was not just his military prowess and bravery that forged the legend. It was his upbringing at the foot of his king father and Aristotle. It was his more than interesting family dynamics, which introduced him at an early age to the harsh realities of leadership during that time. And it was his ability to gather views of trusted advisors, but to decide on a different course and have confidence in his decisions. And it was that gift of gab, his ability to sway and inspire, especially during challenging times, that made him one of history's great orators. Now, if you want to learn or read more about the man beyond the military campaigns, check out John Keegan and his book, The Mask of Command. Keegan is a classic. He's one of the most preeminent historians of the modern age. And I think you'll find any book that he's written more than interesting. And another great unconventional work on Alexander the Great can be found with the book titled The Wisdom of Alexander the Great. Its subtitle is Enduring Leadership Lessons from the Man Who Created an Empire, and it was written by a business school professor of mine, Lance Kirk. We lost Lance a few years ago, but his book on Alexander the Great, it is a great read. Now, don't tell me that you are shocked or have found out over this episode that there was more to Alexander the Great than what you saw in the movies or that you heard in pop culture. Well, speaking of Alexander the Great showing up in pop culture, let's conclude our special edition episode of The Far Metal with a connection to an iconic heavy metal band from England, the band Iron Maiden. It's been a longtime favorite of mine, and they are one of the two linchpins of the heavy metal's new wave movement in the 1970s, Judas Priest from Birmingham being the other. I'm an even bigger admirer of Judas Priest, by the way. And one of these days, I'll get around to publishing something on the new wave of heavy metal. That would be a fun undertaking. But back to Iron Maiden and how the band has a connection to Alexander the Great. Back in the mid-1980s, Iron Maiden released, I think it was its sixth studio album, titled Somewhere in Time. And that record's closing song is titled Alexander the Great. It is classic Iron Maiden, runs over 8 minutes in length. Instrumental sections at the opening and in the middle and the close of the song, and lyrically it covers Alexander's career in Cliff Notes version. And that's what I always loved about Iron Maiden. It wasn't the album visual art or the mascot Eddie or the theatrics in concert that so many fans love. For me, it was first and foremost the fact that they are an incredibly complex musical band, both instrumentally and lyrically. If you listen to Iron Maiden lyrics, you're going to learn and you're going to absorb a lot of history, which for their core audience back in the day of mostly adolescent boys, that was a clandestine way to inject a little worldly knowledge into their lives beyond the myopic city or small town that they hailed from. Hardcore fans know that the band Iron Maiden never played Alexander the Great live until last year. And they're coming to my town later this year. I plan on being there. And maybe they play Alexander the Great. It's time to go. I bid you farewell for a week. And as always, I urge you to stay connected to that far middle.